nature.
Very nice.
Yes. Yes, I can do that.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Alors, vas-y.
Sure, so I'll talk about that. Personally, I think with making decision, I think it's very important to not make it such a major, major thing. Because yes, you have a major decision to take, but to be careful not to do too much what I call futuring. Because if you take a decision and you think, this decision will make a difference to the next 40 years of my life, then you are like paralyzed. Because if I ever, if it's a wrong one, then my 40 years of life or 30 or 20 are going to be like terrible. So personally, I would say when you make a decision, don't make it more than 2 years. You know, plan the next 2 years. Think, okay, I make that decision and possibly could have this kind of in the next 2 years. 5 at the very, very most. So that actually you leave a little leeway. You're not in this, it's so frightening to take this decision because the whole of my life rests upon this one moment. Then you kind of, the fear is very great. So I think, in a way, when we make a decision, it depends what it is about. For example, if it's a decision about which direction to go in one's life, I think it's, again, very important not to go into too much abstraction, to be careful of stories, and to really go back to what is it I like, what is it I am good at, what is it I want to learn, and upon that, then making the decision. Also, when making a decision, I think it's very important to know, by making this decision, we'll gain something, and at the same time, we will lose something. I know there is a lot of talk of win-win situation, but I think often, when whatever decision we make, generally, yes, something will be better, but we generally always often aspire to perfection. But generally, something can be a little better, but by doing that, generally, you lose also a little something. And so it's kind of choosing, what is it? What is it I am gaining? What is it I'm going to lose? And in a way, to accept both, to really accept both. And to be careful, either to be too focused on what you're going to lose, or too focused on what you're going to gain. But try it again the middle way, to see both. And also to wait. I would say, unless you really have to make the decision in the next minute, I would say to generally wait. Wait a little, because often what there is this difficulty with being with the fact that we don't know yet. And so in order not to have this funny feeling of knowing, not knowing what we're going to do yet, then we make a decision, which sometimes we might regret. And personally, I feel if you wait, I mean, you don't have to wait years, but if you wait a little so that in yourself something forms, and then when you make the decision, generally, actually, you don't have to worry about it. You just make it. Because at that moment, finally, something has come together in your whole body and mind complex, and then you will make the decision, and then you will see what happened, because it's always a mystery. If it goes the way you think it's going to go, or not the way it's going to, it's supposed to go.
In Hebrew, we have a phrase about decision. It's not, we don't make a decision, we receive a decision.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually indicates some sort of a fruition of conditions and terms that arise, then you can receive the decision.
Yeah, I think decision, I mean, my experience of people who are drawn to meditation, sometimes people come with the motive that if I meditate long and deep and hard enough, then some little voice within me will tell me what to do. And that, I think, is very rarely the case. And in fact, it can even have the opposite effect. Sometimes if you meditate on the choice you have to make or the uncertainty you have around an issue, it can sometimes just magnify the uncertainty. And you become almost paralyzed by your inability to deal with this now ever greater crisis of uncertainty. So I think what the practice of the Dharma can provide is not answers or little voices telling you what to do, but it can give you a foundation of courage and stability in your life in which you are more able to take the risk. Because every choice you make is a risk, for this very simple reason: we cannot possibly know the outcome of our decisions. Impossible. Absolutely impossible. So we have to acknowledge that every major choice, even minor choice in life, contains an element of risk. We might actually make things a lot worse. And we need, I think, to have the honesty and the courage to acknowledge that. Yes, and then there. Well, craving for non-existence is basically when things get so tough, you think, well, the best solution would be just to end it all. It's suicide. It's thinking that I'll solve my all problems by deleting myself. And, you know, people do that, as we know. It is one way out of the dilemma. But it seems an abdication from the... From the challenge of living fully and completely. To me, the whole notion of fully knowing suffering, to commit yourself to that, is to commit yourself to life, to commit yourself to no suffering through to the very end, to not be tempted, as it were, to simply say, this is too much, I can't stand it anymore, and to kill yourself, but rather to, again, through the practice, finding resources, courage and inner strength that enable you to learn and to increase your understanding, your empathy for life through in a sense, opting out of life by taking it.
Kira?
Yes? Was there a question here, or was it you?
Aaron,
yes.
While reflecting about the seminar of yesterday, about what distinguish what the Buddha taught from the Upanishad, few things came to mind. I would be happy to hear your response. Mm-hmm. Firstly, there was a feature there of the mind practice of mindfulness, and in another feature you mentioned the Four Noble Truths.
Mm. Well, you could boil it all down to the four truths, actually. In the four truths, you have the idea of conditioned arising is already there, the idea of mindfulness is already there, the idea of self-reliance is already there. And in a way, that's what, for me, the teaching of the Buddha comes down to, is the four truths. Everything is there. But if one wants to highlight particular features, and that's why I made this silly list of these four P's. Conditioned arising is, as it were, a kind of a guiding principle. The Four Truths and the Eightfold Path describe a process. Mindfulness describes an ongoing praxis. And self-reliance describes one's relationship to authority and power. But no, in fact, you could just boil it down to the Four Truths. But that's maybe not quite so helpful in that particular instance of differentiating what the Buddha was saying from at least my understanding of that earlier tradition. Yes?
And on the other hand, you didn't mention, like, in the list, in the 4P, the anatta.
Well, anatta...
It doesn't have a T, but...
Well, actually, anatta is, again, effectively the same as conditioned arising, strictly speaking. Things are without self because they are arising dependently. That is the formulation we find in Nagarjuna. That may not be so explicitly stated in the Pali text. But I would see the two as really just different facets, one of the other. But I'd be all too happy to find a fifth or sixth or seventh or eighth or ninth or tenth thing to add to the list. And that would be perhaps a candidate. But I would see it as really just another way of understanding this idea of paticca samuppada.
Next,
yeah. First, I would like to ask that if I sit and I have I let go, I just keep my mind on letting go, resting, stuff like this. Then the thought will come and take over, and then I feel like somehow relaxed because I don't have the struggle inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I also feel like I just don't do anything, which is also quite nice, not to do anything. But I miss the point. I feel like that I miss the point if I do let go. And the grasping is a grasp on the idea that I need to clear up my mind and keep my focus
mm-hmm.
on something very simple like my prayer.
Mm-hmm. I think we can probably both respond to that. I mean, the question I think you have to ask yourself is why is it? What's the point of letting go? Why? And I think each of us has to somehow make that intelligible. I don't think letting go is an end in itself, but it is part of this process of coming to a place in your life where you can begin to live from another perspective.
I think, although my book, last book is called Let Go, but it's not my idea, it's a publisher idea. I think the problem with Let Go is that you have the feeling you're doing something. That's why I prefer to talk about creative engagement. Because you see, I think there is different types, let's say, of letting go. There is different type of non-grasping. There is different type of creative engagement. If we talk about just, you know, sitting in meditation, sometimes, yes, it is like, it seems like a fight. Because the thoughts are taking you away, and then you have to bring them back, and you feel, you know, this is hard work. But at other time, you feel it just happened by itself. You're just very quiet, calm, and clear, and the thought arises, but there is no stickiness to them. You don't stick to them, they don't stick to you. And so I think sometimes we have to do more like kind of, you know, actively doing something, but we can't do that all the time, because that would be too forcing, too tiring. So I would say that when we actually sit in meditation, we're not looking for a constant state. But just at time, you have to put more energy. At other time, it just happened by itself. Sometimes you're kind of sleepy, so you have to wake yourself up. And so the meditation is not about letting go as much as cultivating the concentration and the inquiry, which then will help you to develop the creative awareness, which then when you go into your daily life, you might see that you are grasping less. But you're not telling yourself, don't grasp, don't grasp, don't grasp. You come in contact, you see something, you hear something, and you just stay there. You don't think, oh, I really need this, or yes, I could have it. I mean, what is interesting is the intensity. of in that encounter? Is there this thirst, or is it just, oh, I am coming in contact with this? Do I need to do something about it or not? So I think it's not like constantly you're letting go of something. I think that actually by the cultivation of the samatha and the vipassana, then when it's useful, then the letting go will happen when you can. Some other part will be more sticky because it's more habitual, it's more ingrained, and then you might have to work more on it in different ways. So personally, I would say it's kind of like a process, this letting go. It's not kind of like I must let go. It's not like that. It's in the cultivation of the samatha and the vipassana that then, in different ways, this non-grasping can happen, this releasing. But personally, I would say it's actually very subtle that when we sit in meditation, I feel there is two meditators. There is a real one sitting there, hot right now, and there is the next one, the one next to him, which is generally the imagined, idealized meditator. And the idealized one generally has no thought, is starting to lift off, and is extremely peaceful. And there is generally this comparison between the two. When actually what you're doing is just to cultivate. And what is interesting for me is that at the end of it, generally, not in the doing of it, the samatha, the vipassana, but at the end of the sitting or the walking, generally you feel a little something, what I call the effect, a little releasing. I became aware of it when I would sit by myself in Korea for 3 months. And I would sit in meditation and it did not work. I had lots of thought, I was sleepy, and I thought, well, it would be, let's do something more useful than this which is not working. Let's go and read the Dharma book. So I sit down, read the Dharma book, I realized I could not read it because actually, even though it did not look like it was working, it had. My mind was more restful, peaceful, and I did not really want to grasp at anything. I just needed to sit there with the thought and whatever. So anyway, to see the letting go actually often is not what I would call a blazing, conscious letting go. Often what it is, it's more like a releasing. So that there is less holding.
Yes.
It's not exactly a question, it's more of a comment.
Uh-huh.
I'm hoping to respond to. Previously this morning you said that it's easier to love our children and our family than to love Arab Americans. The first thing that came to my mind when you said that was the story about the Buddha leaving his wife and child in order to attain awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I can say that my children are my main reason to practice. They are the ones who brought me to the cushion and to practice. And they are actually my way of connecting practice to life and actually applying what I'm doing on the cushion. And I'd be happy to hear what you think.
People are nowadays very often troubled by the fact that the Buddha had his first child at a relatively late age, 28, and no sooner was the child sort of a year or so old than he runs off. And it's not the sort of model we would like to encourage in our society, perhaps. I think we have to be very careful of reading that story through the eyes of the kind of world, the kind of modern world that we see things now from a sort of feminist perspective and so on and so forth. I think the real shock in the Buddha's departure was not the leaving of his wife and his child, but the leaving of his community. In fact, you could I would argue that in fact that the Buddha Well, he was just the young man Gautama at that time. By having a child, he fulfilled his obligation to his family in a way. He left an heir, and so he may have thought, although I don't want to pretend that I can think through in his thoughts, but it may have been that actually allowed him, because in an extended Indian family of that kind, the actual, you know, the child is embraced by the whole extended family. The child has a role in that world, whether or not the father is alive or there. So I don't think we need to take it as the equivalent of a young man of 28 today in a little nuclear family in a flat in Tel Aviv who gives birth to his child and then goes off to become a monk in India. I mean, that I think would probably be very irresponsible. But it's a different social environment in which you have to understand that as having taken place. The other point is that he could well have been motivated, I think he probably was, to try to seek some insight, some understanding of life that could actually be of value to his family and to his community. And it's quite striking that within a year or two of the awakening, he comes back to Kapalavatu, he comes back to his homeland, he reconciles himself with his father, with his stepmother, with his wife, with his son. He takes the son into the order of monks. And then he remains involved with the affairs of his clan, the Sakyans, right through to the very end of his life. So it's not as though he abandoned the family and never came back. In fact, he did. And in fact, he endlessly, I don't want to go into all the details, but many of the events that then afflicted him in later life were the result of the ambitions and the misdeeds of his close relatives. So he was always involved with his family, in fact, even though he didn't return to family life.
You see, I think, in a way, what one has to be careful here is not to say that one should not, again, it's the difference between caring and learning from raising children, having family and everything. But to see, in a way, the distinction we make when we start to grasp at the people we love. And it's interesting, what is it we're really loving? Are we really loving the person? Are we loving the feeling the persons give us? Are we grasping at the person, grasping at the feeling they give us? Or really appreciating them, caring for them and loving them with what I would call creative wise love. So I think it's a difference between maybe a more grasping, fixing, limiting love, which often when you do that, then actually there is the one you love and you attach to and you grasp at, and then there is the other one which you don't care for or are possibly the enemy. So in a way it's kind of trying to come to a love which of course has different layers, from children to family to etc. etc. But with the Buddha, you really have this very strong feeling that he really thought of a love which was universal in terms of equality, that you kind of, you know, try to have equal, I mean, of course there is degrees, but you try to love everybody you encounter. You try to be open to every human being, to every sentient being. And to me, at the base of that love, there is the recognition of life, the equality of life, and also the suffering of life. So I think it's more in that context.
I mean, it's characteristic of the lives of many what we would consider to be great people, is that they sacrifice their families for a higher purpose or goal. Think, for example, of Aung San Suu Kyi. She didn't have to stay in Burma in prison for 20 years. In doing so, she left her children in Oxford. And it hasn't been easy for them. I know people who know them. It's been very hard. She could have come back, but she didn't. She chooses to make that sacrifice for her people, essentially, in this case. And I think you can think of many examples. Che Guevara. He may not be a great hero of you, but he led, again, a kind of almost archetypically heroic life. He left five children in Havana and then went off to Bolivia in a fruitless campaign to try and generate revolution there. He ended up dead. Nelson Mandela, too. You know, they take that as a sacrifice that is made, and I'm sure it's not made lightly. But at a certain point, it's this decision making again. At a certain point, you have to say, well, what are my real priorities here? And at sometimes that will be a very painful decision. And I think the Buddha is perhaps archetypal of that kind of choice.
Next question? Yeah.
Yes.
Related to what you said about grasping things less tightly, it's a process that I realized I'd achieved some grasping less tightly over a number of years, and it could be that this practice is part of it. And that's a good experience in which my life is better. So the question is about a contradiction between this practice and is a means to grasping. So I'm going to sit here, and I know that I don't expect the result now, but it could be good for my life. And then, I mean, I don't know what people talk about non-dual traditions, but so there's this pressure on my practice from reading about Dzogchen or whatever other non-dual traditions there are, that's saying it's not a means. It's not, don't use it as a means. It's like it. I don't know if I'm inventing a problem there, but.
Well, it's just, you know, two different points of view, and, you know, what is it, which one is talking more to you? You see, one has to be careful about saying one is true, one is not true. I think we have to be careful of truth. You know, truth, especially with a big T. Personally, I'm not interested in truth with a big T. But I think any theory is just conditioned. So the thing is to see what fits my way of seeing the world, what helps me. You see, what I found interesting, once I was teaching and I stayed with a lady who was very much part of the Indian tradition, and she said, you know, she would sit with her friend and had fantastic, fantastic time with them. But when she had cancer, what helped was Vipassana meditation. But it doesn't stop her from still going and sitting with her Hindu friend who followed the non-dual teaching. But she did not find, when she had cancer, that the non-dual teaching was helping. But Vipassana sure is helping. So it's kind of, again, what works for you at what time. And you see, when people say things, well, personally I would say, who cares? You know, it's, you have to look at your experience. You know, I mean, if I have a lot of friends who do Vipassana and are very attracted by the what they call the non-dual teaching. And my little opinion, maybe we should not record this. It's just between you and me. I think the non-dual teaching is more emotionally satisfying, but Vipassana works. So it's what you choose. A lot of them do the two together. Personally, non-dual teaching doesn't do anything for me. But this is because of me, not because of it.
I mystified something by saying non-dual, because I'm out of my depth in the sense I probably didn't know exactly what I was talking about. But, you know, it's like, but there is a thrust in Buddhist teachings generally, or in any meditative tradition, about being in the here and now. It's to do with that, isn't it? So I'm trying to keep this contradiction alive by saying I'm sitting here trying to learn about that my life would be better if it was more in the here and now, but I'm cultivating something.
Yeah, but this is again, you have the difference with what I would call what the mix-up is between aspiration and expectation. I mean, you could just sit there and do nothing whatsoever. But even if you have the goal of no goal, you still have the goal of no goal. Stephen can give a talk on that, on the five factors. One of the factors of existence is intentionality. So even if you sit with no goal, you'll have the seat. Even you always have the goal to be here and now. I mean, there is always intentionality. And then it's kind of to see, to me, the difference is between aspiration and expectation. Aspiration is, I personally aspire to wisdom and compassion. And that gives me the energy to cultivate something so I can just develop it more and more. Expectation would be, I want to be awakened here and now, yesterday. And if I am not, I am upset. Or I am this, or I am that, etc. To me, this is a difference. We generally, we don't sit there because we have nothing better to do. We generally sit there because there is an aspiration. Our actions are motivated. I'm not saying that people cannot think differently. That's fine. But then they don't do meditation, they do something else. But to me, this works. I did it, and it helps me to develop wisdom and compassion, which is my aspiration, so it fits. So I think it's kind of in a way to see for myself, how can I put it together? I think this is very much that. How can I put it together?
Well, here, an example of someone who was very committed to the practice of being totally in the here and now, and yet, you know, had enormous responsibilities in the concrete world, is that of Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor of the 4th century, who was a Stoic, who is the author of the Meditations. It's a beautiful text. Now, Marcus Aurelius, this was a guy who was defending the Roman Empire against the invading Germans. So he had, he had some real things he had to realize. He had a real job to do, and yet he every day he would write down his reflections from a religious or, let's say, more philosophical point of view, as sort of reminders of guidelines as how he can achieve those goals most fruitfully. And one of them, a very central one, was of living fully in the present. And I think those sort of concrete examples are perhaps more useful. I think what it might sound paradoxical, but I think that one is perhaps best equipped to deal with the challenges of life that are confronting you in the future by being more totally present with how you actually are right now. That gives you a ground on which to make such choices and to which to make such plans with a real kind of stability, a real kind of basis, which is very much in the here and now. And yet, you are when you plan, you do so totally in a full awareness of how you are in that moment, of what the situation is present to you in the moment. You're not drifting in some sort of abstract fantasy idea as to what would be best, what would be worst. All your decisions are rooted in your sense of being here in this body now. So I don't think there's a contradiction at all. In fact, I think the two really can't go one without the other, frankly. Yes, and then here, and then you can have another go. Yes.
When Martin was giving the instructions for meditation in the first evening, he went back to that quote from the Buddha going under the tree and washing your feet. And you talked a little about letting go of the greed and hatred, and then if you could elaborate more on the positive instruction, the relation towards the self and the other person.
What? To me, this is what I'll talk a little about in the Dana talk this afternoon, is in a way the attitude with which we sit. Because when we sit in meditation, actually we come to the meditation moment with what I would call patterning, mental habits, emotional habits, and physical habits. And I think in a way often these habits, not all of them, but some of them are a little negative. Often we come with, I would say, a lot of judging. So in a way, we sit in meditation, we watch the breath, and then the next minute, am I doing this right? And somebody is to make too much noise, and they kind of go into kind of judging. And in a way, to try, what I think the Buddha is trying to say, is that could we, in a way, our internal structure, could we shift it more toward, in a way, the welfare, more toward a kind of kind attitude, so that when I sit in meditation, to actually cultivate harmlessness. What does it mean? I sit, I don't do anything, so at that level physically I am harmless. I don't speak, I am harmless. But in my mind, what does it mean to be harmless? And actually it's to kind of nearly look at the language we use to speak to ourselves and to see if we can soften that language in connection to others, soften that language in connection to the world. Because sometimes you sit in meditation and suddenly you see yourself plotting revenge. You know, that you kind of like, wait a minute. And then you kind of look, how can I transform it? Not judge that I'm doing this, but kind of, I think the Buddha was saying, how can you transform, in a way, the kind of the inner landscape into this kind of having more your welfare to the front, the welfare of other to the front, the welfare of the world to the front. So it's kind of like this, kind of back to being aware of what is going on, and also to see, can there be this shift, which is not a forcing, like you're not forcing yourself, I must be a positive, kind Buddhist now, not only have kind thought all the time, not that, but it's kind of this kind of seeing, what am I thinking, is this true? Could I think something else? Could I think it differently? So it's kind of like kind of trying, and this is very clear from the Buddha when he says that one of his breakthroughs way at the beginning, where then he found himself very fearful, in fear and dread, he says. And then he thought, wait, why am I in fear and dread? Could not I do something about this? And he just sat, and he kind of watched it, but he did not get caught in it. To me, that seems to be his kind of first movement of that nature, to see that he could do something about his inner mental landscape. There was...
Yes.
And then he... Oh! yes, and then this person.
Having defined yourself as a secular Buddhist, mm-hmm. you imply that Buddhism is a religion. If you're a secular Buddhist, Buddhism is a religion. And although it doesn't have a god, there are many things that it has that all the three big religions have.
Uh-huh.
A set of do's and don'ts,
yeah.
A prescription for daily practice, canonical texts,
priests,
and an offering for salvation.
Well, it's Buddhism is, you can't, to say that Buddhism is not a religion is simply going to fly in the face of reality.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a plane to Bangkok, go to a Buddhist temple and tell me that that's not a religion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it is. And Buddhism functions as a religion and has functioned as a religion for most of its history. But one could perhaps argue, as has in fact been argued for Christianity and even Islam, that Buddhism became a religion. It didn't necessarily start out like that. If you look at the, if you try to imagine yourself in the world of the Buddha's time, there are very little, if any, features of the community's behavior that you would call religious, in a visible sense. There were no altars, there was no offerings, there was no images, there was no cult in that sense, but it became a religion. I feel in a way the Buddha, as I said this morning, envisioned a new kind of society. That in India at least never really happened, but Buddhism certainly has thrived as a religion. But I don't consider myself to be a religious person. I'm not wired that way, and yet the teachings of the Buddha speak very directly to my condition. So I don't consider myself to be a religious Buddhist, but of course I acknowledge that for most Buddhists, Buddhism is a religion, and it serves not only the personal religious needs, but also it functions as a religion in terms of how it operates and serves the community in different Buddhist societies. It obviously is a religion, but I don't think it has to be. I don't think that's somehow a necessary way for any particular person who seeks to live their life according to the Buddha's teaching, need not, I think, do so in an overtly religious way.
Last question, I think.
Well, I have two.
Okay.
The first question regards second question. Yesterday you talked about meditation brings to more acceptance and transformation. So I wish that I could hear some more inspiring words about the transformation. The second question regards how you view the relation between trust.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the guides or one of the
mm-hmm.
things that helps us on the path, and the confidence we have in the Triple Gem
mm-hmm.
on the one hand, and on the other hand the self-reliance.
Mm-hmm. Well, paradoxically, you see, when the Buddha describes this stream, entering the stream, you get both. On the one hand, you become autonomous because your practice is now grounded not so much in what you believe, but what you've actually known for yourself. That's the basis of autonomy. But that autonomy is not just a kind of random, chaotic, I'll do what I want now kind of autonomy. I mean, I've often heard people say that, you know, the Buddha said you must only act out of your own experience. There's a famous passage at the very end of the Buddha's life where he says, Ananda, you should be islands to yourselves. You should be an island to yourself. To have yourself as your island. And you should have the Dhamma as your island. So he's actually giving a mix. He's saying, you should be autonomous, but your autonomy operates within the framework of values as laid out in the principles of the Dhamma. So one can have confidence and trust in that framework of living, but the authority for every single step you make comes from your own experience. It's both. He's not just saying just do your own thing. That would be, I think, would mean very little. On the other hand, he's not saying you must do X, you must do Y, you must do Z, and you must follow me, and you mustn't disobey what your guru says. So he's giving, he's encouraging autonomy, but within a framework of values and practices and goals and purposes. And that is how I would balance the two out. So I don't see them as, I see them as mutually complementary, not as contradictory at all.
Transformation, quickly, in 1 minute. Actually, I see two facets of the creative awareness as acceptance and transformation. The two really go together. You have to accept first, which for me means you have to know experientially what is going on in order to transform it. For example, you have to really know your good quality to be able to cultivate them more, to be more confident with your good quality and say, oh, I am quite a good person. I can cultivate this, I can cultivate that, which then in turn will make you develop more of it. Again, with the negative quality we have, the acceptance, the seeing, this is the way it is, this is what's going on, then make you see, I don't do this all the time. These arise upon condition. What is the trigger? What is the contributing factor? What can I do about it? What is the limit in which I can work? So to me, the two actually, the acceptance leads to the transformation. And sometimes it's kind of the transformation is actually in the acceptance. And sometimes the transformation is in transforming the outer condition. And sometimes the transformation is in transforming the inner condition. And sometimes the two can be transformed together. So I think it's kind of like, the meditation, it's back. I know I keep going back to samatha and vipassana, but I think this is the main point of what we're doing, is that the samatha and the vipassana makes us more in tune with what is going on. So we kind of start to connect to our experience in a different way. We see it differently. Instead of being identified with it, we start to see, there is all these things contributing to this. So we start to feel less stuck. Often I have the feeling we fix ourselves. I am always like this. It will always be like this. There is this very kind of fixing, limiting. And with the meditation, we kind of start to see, no, I change. My thought change, my sensation, my feeling, the environment, whatever, lots of things change. And then we become more aware of the changing nature. We then reduce this fixing tendency. And also we start over time to develop the power of creative awareness. So then we can start to see when actually we're wise and compassionate, and when we're not. And when we're not, we start to notice not the middle of it, but the beginning. That's what is interesting. When we go to do something, and we kind of start to see, I am going to do this. I have done this for the last 10, 20, 30 years. And suddenly you think, maybe I could do something else. And at that moment, you have a great fear. And this is why we don't change. We prefer the pain of what we know than the non-pain of what we don't know. But if we cultivate the power of creative awareness, then we, that one day, decide to maybe I can do something different. And if you do this, you feel such ease. And you feel, why did not I do it before? Because the power of the habit was stronger. And then you don't do it again. But we don't do it again because of compassion now. Because then finally we realize the pain, the suffering of ourselves and of others. And then we can't do it again. Because we finally know it. And then we have compassion for ourselves and for others. So this is very short. So now we're going to eat, and it looks like we're going to do something very dreadful in Tovana, that we're going to break the silence at lunchtime. However, I don't want to be too traumatic. So personally, why do I suggest this? Is because I think it's very important for two things. One is for you to get to know each other, to meet each other, and to talk with each other. And I think this is an important part, especially if this retreat has been silent. I think it's an important moment to meet yourself back to where you are, in a way. You were meeting more as human being, and now it's back to human being and personality, back meeting together. And then what is interesting to me at that level of breaking the silence is cultivating meditative awareness when you speak and when you listen. And so I see this talking at lunchtime as working on your meditative listening and talking muscle with awareness. And to really see it, how can I, because it's so important in our daily life, to bring that meditative listening, that meditative speaking. However, if some people, for whatever reason, want to continue to be in the silence because they find it beneficial and helpful, we thought that the best way to deal with this would be that when we serve the food, we remain in silence. When we sit at the table in the kitchen, in the dining room, then we can talk. The people who don't want to talk then can eat outside in the shade. And the meditation room is also quiet. And then at 3 o'clock, then the silence will be totally officially broken. I hope this is suitable for everyone. So have a good lunch. And we meet here again at 2:15.
Just recorders?
No, they're MP3 players. They're MP3 players, which recording. I'm going to stop it now.